Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Frank Vasquez. I'm here on behalf of International Finance Corporation. Seated at the table with me today are Frank Panopoulos and Jonathan Ulrich, who are the co-authors of the briefs, and also Mr. Kareem Sarakar, who is an attorney with the International Finance Corporation. We've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. I think any this case concerns a very unusual area of the law, which is the immunity accorded to international organizations. I think any discussion of that necessarily begins with the court's decision in Atkinson versus Inter-American Development Bank. In that case, this court decided that the kind of immunity that was going to be accorded to these organizations was the absolute immunity that was accorded to foreign sovereigns in 1945. Specifically, the court ruled also that, unlike the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, there are no list of enumerated exceptions. For instance, there's no commercial activity exception that's in play here. What you come out with is a blanket of immunity that's subject only to very limited waivers in specific cases that have to do with whether the particular activity involved in particular claim and claimant would further the interests of the international organization, in this case, International Finance Corporation. I think that the district court made a couple of different errors. One was the method of analysis, and another one is the analysis itself. What the district court did was to impose essentially a blanket waiver of immunity over a whole genre of potential claimants.
Well, isn't that... that's what happened in Atkinson. Atkinson said there's a waiver for all garnishment suits for employee wages, all garnishment suits of any kind.
No, I think it said there was no waiver.
I'm sorry, it had declined to, right.
Yeah.
But it had declined to waive it for a blanket group, not specific ones. It didn't go through each case. It said it had not.
Yeah, I think. Well, I think that's the principle of absolute immunity,
right?
That there is a blanket of immunity. There cannot be a blanket waiver, and I think that's the way we need to look at these decisions. That
your charter seems to make a blanket waiver.
I don't think that it necessarily does. I think you need to look at each individual case to decide whether that particular claimant and transaction is a one that would be subject to a waiver in a particular circumstance. And I think where the district court fell into the trap to begin with was largely by the approach it took, which
was... What section is that where... The section in the articles that indicates that you're subject to suit?
It's Article 6.
Article 6. And that says actions may be brought against the corporation only in a court of competent jurisdiction, and et cetera, et cetera. And the no action shall be brought by members. The property and assets of the corporation shall be immune from all sorts of seizure, et cetera, except the final judgment of the court. Now, that strikes me as like a kind of a blanket waiver of immunity from litigation. In Atkinson, was there a similar provision?
It's the same provision that was being discussed in Atkinson.
And this all comes from our decision in Mindaro?
In Atkinson and Mindaro are the two the seminal cases here that we're dealing with.
And what was the waiver in Mindaro?
There was no waiver in Mindaro. Mindaro was a suit by an employee against the World Bank. This court held that there was no waiver for that type of suit and that type of claimant. It also said that there are no blanket waivers in this context. Uh-huh. What the Mindaro court did not do was deal with the with actually what type of immunity was afforded to these international organizations, whether it was the same kind of immunity that foreign sovereigns would get under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act or something else. And what the Atkinson court said was that that immunity is actually broader than what's available under the FSIA. It goes back to this absolute immunity that was available to foreign sovereigns in 1945.
But the district court didn't do a blanket waiver here. The district court said IFC's chartered, one of the IFC's chartered functions is to provide funding for these sorts of investments, and that selling its shares in producing revenues that could be then rolled into other investments is consistent with its charter, and therefore it's in the IFC gets a benefit from a waiver of immunity because it can negotiate with people over these kinds of transactions.
Well, I think right? What the district court said
what was wrong with that?
Because the district court said, first of all, it didn't actually look at the facts of the case. It looked at
why did it need to?
But
if that's the type of case that would have benefited the IFC.
But beyond that, the district court said it was applying this to a genre of activity and claimants.
Right.
I think in this case, the district court also found that there actually was no agreement with this potential claimant.
Right.
Even under the facts.
You might win on the merits.
I'm sorry?
You might win on the merits for that reason.
Well, we think that.
But the question is whether there's a waiver of immunity.
We think that question also forecloses immunity in this particular case.
Under, what I don't understand is under your theory, it sounds like the immunity determination is about as complicated as the merits determination.
Well,
isn't that right? I mean, you want to look at each claim, the facts underlying it. You even suggest in the brief that the court has to conclude that the allegations have merit. Isn't that right? I mean,
not necessarily.
No, but that's what you say in your brief.
It would depend on the case. In certain cases, such as this one, some of those facts the court would need to look into. I think when a sovereign or an international organization is confronted with one of these kinds of lawsuits, it has two choices, and I'm following the Phoenix Consulting method of analysis. It can either challenge the complaint facially and say, under the facts of this complaint, I still have immunity. Or it can say, it can challenge the actual facts and put in facts into the case. In that circumstance, the court must resolve whatever facts it deems necessary to resolve the question of immunity. Now, whether those facts go to the merits or not, I don't think is even a useful determination. Because what a court should be doing is looking at each case individually,
and
each claimant.
And the underlying facts.
And
so what's going to be the difference between that undertaking and trying the case on the merits?
I think because the idea of immunity is that you're preserving immunity from suit and not just immunity from jurisdiction,
right,
that the court wants to take the least intrusive way of doing that.
Well, but that's not very unintrusive to your client.
Well, actually,
you're gonna have to, as I said, try the case, which is what you're trying to avoid, right? You're saying you're immune from suit here.
Well, I think the record's already very well developed in this case because there was.
No, but my question is, why is anything in the record relevant other than the fact that the one fact that you all agree to, which is that the plaintiff here and the IFC were in negotiations over this stock transaction. So the question is that the kind of transaction that furthers IFC's chartered purposes? And if it is, then you're not immune. If it isn't, then you're immune.
Well, I don't think it does, because the mere fact that IFC is talking to somebody should not be a waiver of its immunity.
But how can you have an agreement? You would agree, though, that if you have an agreement, there's a waiver of immunity.
Yeah, if you have an
agreement. You can't have an agreement without first talking about it.
I agree with you.
Right?
That
so how do you, for the same reason that you would have immunity, you would not have immunity over litigation over the final agreement, it seems to me fairly logical that that would extend to negotiations leading up to the agreement.
We actually don't believe it should extend that far because there.
How can you have an agreement without negotiations?
I'm not saying it's you can. I'm saying that IFC should be immune until it actually has an agreement, until it's actually doing business with someone.
But if your purpose, if the charter, if one of the purposes, you agree one of the purposes of IFC is to invest in companies and is to do these kinds of investments, and that selling this stock would produce revenue with which IFC could further its chartered purposes, correct?
Yes.
Okay, well, how can it accomplish that without entering into negotiations with individuals over transactions to sell stocks?
It will need to discuss having transactions with parties, but just because IFC has a discussion with a party shouldn't lead to an immediate waiver of its immunity.
Is that because your argument is somewhat along the line of Phoenix, that in determining jurisdiction, the court may have to look at the merits?
That's correct.
And that in what you're asking the court to say is that your Article 6 language should be interpreted to mean that given the blanket nature of your immunity, the only intentional waiver comes when you have formally entered into an agreement?
Essentially, yes, because the danger here is this is an international organization. It's like a government agency. In cases involving government agencies, you have to, this concept goes very far back into U.S. jurisprudence, but also as applied to the U.S. government agencies, but it's also been applied to foreign sovereigns, that you need to turn square corners with these kind of entities, that you can't have casual oral-type contracts and be able to raise your hand and say, oh, hi, I talked to somebody over there, and I think I have a deal, and I'm going to bring a lawsuit.
All right, but why isn't Judge Tatel's point that, maybe putting words into his mouth, that your brief goes too far to argue that you have to reach a determination that the plaintiff would prevail at least on the question of whether there is a contract, because that's basically deciding the merits.
Well, in this case, the judge already decided that there is no contract claim even in the face of the complaint. So that's actually already been decided. So I don't know that detail of analysis would be necessary in this case.
Let's go. I'm sorry, Dick. Are you done? No. Let me take you back to Atkinson and Mandero. They both found no waiver for a category of cases, right? Employment discrimination in one and garnishment in the other, right? So, but there was no specific analysis of those cases. The court didn't look at the facts or the merits of the case. They looked at the category of case, right? That's all they did.
I think that's because you're starting with...
And that's what you're asking for that here, you're right? So even here, if you were... If you're asking for a waiver, you're arguing that IFC has not waived its immunity for this kind of case. So if we were just going to apply the Atkinson-Mandero analysis, we would look at this category of case, namely a case brought by someone challenging this type of agreement, the agreement for sale of stock.
But I think to give justice and effect to the idea of absolute immunity.
No. Just stick with my question about Mandero and Atkinson, okay? You agree with me. They didn't do the kind of analysis you're asking us to do here.
I think they did, in a
they
sense.
They did?
They looked at who it was specifically, what the facts were, and they decided.
They just said garnishment cases, they don't have to waive their immunity to accomplish their purposes. And in the other case, they don't have to waive their immunity for employment discrimination cases. There wasn't any claim-by-claim analysis, or the facts weren't even relevant beyond that, beyond the fact that someone had brought a garnishment case.
Well, that's right. They identified something that would allow them to preserve the immunity, and then that's all you need to do. When you're talking about these types of cases where an entity has immunity of this nature, I think it is possible to say...
Weren't those types of cases? Didn't they involve institutions that had this kind of immunity? They did, right? They were identical.
They did.
One was the World Bank and one was you, right?
No, I believe the other one is the Inter-American
Bank. I'm sorry, the Inter-American Bank. But we all agree that their charters are identical.
Essentially.
Yeah, okay. So my only point is this. I'll just try once again. Is that I don't see in those cases the kind of analysis you're asking us to undertake here. They just looked at the two categories of cases and made the judgment about whether waiver of immunity of those categories of cases was necessary to further the institution's chartered purposes.
I think
that's it. They didn't do anything else.
Part of that, though, is the nature of the challenge that was made to begin with, which mm-hmm. was a facial challenge on the basis of a complaint, or one of them was a declaratory judgment.
Isn't that what this is here? We have a complaint.
Yes, but
we
have asked that the court consider the facts.
I know you have, and what I'm asking you is, where is there authority for us asking those questions given the analysis that was undertaken in Atkinson and Mendero? In fact, do you know any case that's engaged in this kind of analysis?
Well, I think the cases where you see this type of analysis, and this goes to the reason why the district court assumed the facts of the complaint were true, citing this Jerome Stevens Farm.
Let's assume he was wrong about that.
Okay.
Okay. What difference does it make?
Because you go to what is the right way to do this.
No. Given the analysis of Mendero and Atkinson, even if the district court was wrong about that statement, what difference does it make? Because you don't argue that you weren't in negotiations with the plaintiff. That's not a contested fact. You don't argue that you weren't in negotiations over this particular type of transaction, right? That's given. And in view of Atkinson and Mendero, what more do we need to resolve the immunity question?
I think what you need, well, I think it's important to go to the method of analysis, because we rely on the Phoenix Consulting case, as the appellee has cited. This issue as to how to go about this analysis has not been dealt with by a court of appeals. We believe that it should be dealt with in the manner that's described in Phoenix Consulting.
I have some questions for you.
Yes.
State the test, would you, that you believe the Mendero stands for?
Mendero merely stands for the proposition that there are no blanket waivers, that it's possible to find areas where you're definitely immune, but there are no blanket waivers. I don't think you can take much more out of Mendero, simply because Mendero didn't address the question that Atkinson addressed, which was, what kind of immunity is this?
The assumption has been that Mendero stands for the proposition that if you had immunity with respect to a particular activity, and that would... And it would interfere with the accomplishment of your mission, then we can assume that you've waived the immunity. Is that a fair statement of the Mendero holding?
I think Mendero and Atkinson both said that we're going to allow waivers of immunity in cases where...
Define waivers of immunity, not allowed. Yeah.
Where it would further the act, the... goals of the corporation.
I sat on Atkinson, and I have a fundamental problem with that whole approach. And let me express it to you, and then to your opponents. I don't know what business a court has telling an organization that you really shouldn't have immunity here because it's going to interfere with the accomplishment of your mission. If an organization wants to invoke immunity, then it interferes. That's the organization's business. And Judge Tatel's questions about what more do we need really expose this problem. If I were, as a judge, were going to make any kind of an evaluation, I would have to get into a factual determination about what kind of activities you engage in, who do you negotiate with, what are the effects of holding that anybody that negotiates with you that doesn't consummate a contract cannot sue you because they'll have immunity? Is that going to affect your organization in an adverse way? Does it mean that people won't negotiate with you? That's all forward-looking. All these cases that, well, all, Mandaro and Atkinson, both are forward-looking. What will the effect be in the future? And I don't know how to make that judgment. It may be that the only effect here would be that somebody is not going to rely on your client's word until they dot all the I's and cross all the T's and have it in writing. That may be the only effect. Will that interfere with your mission? I don't know.
Well, it would not, and that's we've actually explained that in the submissions that we've made.
But none of that, none of those things that I've just gone on too long about really have anything to do with the way that you're arguing this case. You're arguing the case about the specifics of what this guy did on a certain day, and we have to get into whether he was telling the truth about this and so on and so forth. None of what I said has anything to do with that. I mean, isn't Judge Tatel absolutely right to get into the details of this is totally inconsistent with Mandaro and to a certain extent with Atkinson?
I don't think so, because if you go the other way, what you end up doing is carving out essentially what are commercial activity exceptions or blanket waivers, if you will. I think that
the article looks pretty blanket to me. So.
I think that you really do want to, and we wanted to present those facts and have the court look at them, that the way IFC does do business is only, it's not by handshakes or emails, it's by written agreements, and that's how an international organization has to function. It's essentially a quasi-government agency.
So that's that to me is an argument that giving us immunity prior to execution, formal execution of the contract, is not going to impair our ability to operate at all, because
it has not. Yeah,
because everybody knows you have to execute the formal contract before you can rely on it. Period.
So, do you agree that if there was a formal contract here, there would be no immunity?
Correct. Then we'd be litigating over the consequences of the contract.
Why isn't that a blanket waiver? I mean, you would want us to do that without looking at the specifics of the case?
No, for instance, you could have a claimant with a contract. It would be a waiver over the contents of the contract itself. It would not be a waiver over other claims unrelated to the contract. And you can think of, you know, many circumstances where a litigant may bring a number of claims, some of them that are based on a contract, some of them based on
something. Why, under your theory, why wouldn't you want us to look? I mean, suppose the complaint had three different counts. And would you want us to look count by count and look at the underlying facts and see whether the case had merit?
Possibly, but not necessarily. It would depend on what the nature of the...
See, I don't understand the difference between... I'm not sure I get why the difference between... I don't understand why if you are conceding that a general rule that IFC has no immunity over contracts over the sale of stocks, right?
Or the subject matter of the contract.
Yeah.
But we
can reach that conclusion, and we would reach that conclusion by what? Saying contracts like that are consistent, are necessary. You need to enter into those contracts to perform your mission, right?
Yeah, that's the way IFC conducts business. Yeah.
But not garnishment, wage garnishments.
Yeah.
And what's the difference?
The reason that the wage garnishments were outside of it it's a different kind of analysis, because in that circumstance, you're talking about the international organization as a third party, essentially, that is being asked to pay for somebody else's judgment, if you will.
Okay,
as a third party, there's a number of cases now which say you can't.
Let me just ask one more question, because you're out of time. So, given your concession that there would be no immunity had this matured to a contract, what exactly is it that you believe the court has to find Is it your position that no negotiations leading up to the contract can ever be the subject of an immunity waiver? Is that your position?
No, I don't think we'd take that kind of extreme position, but you'd have to analyze specific facts in order to get there. For instance,
those facts would have to show that the lawsuit had merit, right? That's what you're saying.
They would have to show a sufficient relationship between IFC and whoever you're talking about, that that you could find that this was necessary for IFC's mission. In this circumstance, we're also arguing, though, that the court applied the wrong law, and that, at least with respect to the promissory estoppel claim, that claim shouldn't be available because the parties in this case intended to operate under the law of Guernsey, because they're talking about a Guernsey corporation operating in Lebanon. I think all of those kinds of facts may be relevant to this kind of analysis. What's important to us is that the court actually undertake this kind of analysis and not assume that the facts of the complaint are true without giving an international organization the opportunity to challenge the underlying facts that they believe relevant to the determination.
You've got to wrap it up. You're way, way over.
I'm sorry.
We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Michael Joseph for the appellee, Salah Oseran. The district judge had it absolutely right. He simply applied Mandaro to this case. He found that allowing prospective purchasers of IFC's investments to enforce liabilities arising out of their negotiations served the purposes of IFC and enabled it to perform its functions. Indeed,
who knows that better than the corporation itself?
Well,
who is in a better position to decide whether immunity will hurt us and hinder us in performing our functions in the future, a district judge or the corporation?
I think it's actually a matter of logic. It's a matter of general understanding of how commercial transactions work. I don't think the international organization can be relied upon to be entirely objective in these decisions, because obviously it never wants to be sued. This court in the Mandaro case had no problem applying normal principles of commercial transactions in concluding, and I quote, that potential investors would be much less likely to acquire the bank's securities if they could not sue the bank to enforce its liabilities. That's the very finding this court made in Mandaro. Now, perhaps that...
Mandaro was about employee suits, wasn't it?
It was about an employee suit.
Well, isn't that dicta?
It is dicta, but nonetheless, the court recognized that this is a determination that a court, any person with knowledge of commercial transactions can make. In any event, it seems clearly to be the law of Mandaro that's the test to be applied. That's the test this district judge applied. And correctly found it absolutely unnecessary.
What evidence was there of the effect of giving the bank or the corporation having immunity from suits by people that negotiate with it but don't enter into formal contracts? What do we know about the effect of that kind of immunity? Would it mean that people won't negotiate? If that's the case, then it's really surprising that the corporation would claim immunity. Do we know that it simply would mean that people will cut square corners and not rely on anything that the corporation says until they get it in writing?
I don't think we know, and I don't think
How can the district judge make a judgment about that?
The district judge made a judgment about that in the same way that this court has made the similar judgment in the countless cases under the International Organization Immunities Act and the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. I recognize that it may not be the most appropriate way to determine immunity in these cases, but that is the way, the test that this court laid down in Mandero and has followed.
I don't know that it's all that clear.
Well,
maybe the court in Mandero, I grant you, did say that, and then when we got to Atkinson, which was the garnishment case, you know, the holding is that allowing garnishment waiving immunity for garnishment would not advance the purposes of the corporation because that wouldn't attract better employees and it wouldn't matter, you know, that kind of thing. I know it's said.
Well, I think going back to Mandero, if what the court did in Mandero was really narrow what is apparently a very broad waiver of immunity in the Articles of Agreement. So,
that's an excellent point.
So if we don't have this test of, well, will it further the purposes of the organization, then I think we have blanket immunity.
Yes.
And the one thing that the IFC has never really addressed in this case is, well, why is it that allowing suits in transactions of this type will not further your purposes? How will it substantially hamper your abilities? Because those are the tests that Mandero lays out. Mandero says that all you really have to find is that the waiver would arguably enable the organization to advance its purposes.
Do you think the court misspoke in Atkinson? Because as I recall, the court said that, now you just said that the default rule is they've waived immunity. You take a look at the article, it's a broad waiver, and the only question is what you're going to carve out as an area in which they are immune.
Correct.
And in Atkinson, the court sort of flipped that and said the default rule is they're immune. The question is now, where have they waived it? And that depends upon whether it's necessary to waive it to advance the corporation's purposes. It flips that.
Well, it may be read as flipping it because the court in Atkinson went into the history of the meaning of the term. International organizations shall have the same immunities as foreign sovereigns, and the court interpreted that as, well, the immunity that sovereigns had in 1945, I think it was, which was before there were any exceptions, and they had, I don't know if they had the total immunity that the court assumed they had, because in 1945, I believe that foreign sovereigns had no immunity unless the State Department went into court and invoked it on their behalf. And I'm not sure that the State Department was compelled to do that. But that, of course, is a much broader question than was addressed by the court in this case.
Well, let me ask you, why is the court bound to interpret Article 6 as you have suggested?
Well, I think even the court in Mandero recognized that that language is quite broad, and then it kind of thought, well, we don't really think the organization, when they adopted this language, which isn't terribly clear, really intended to waive immunity in all respects. But it seems logical to think that they would have wanted to waive it to the extent that they would receive a corresponding benefit from that. I don't know that the court would have to interpret it that way, but it would have to find some alternative way than the way found in Mandero to get around that apparently broad language.
My point, in other words, is that Article 6 is there. This court has, at least in Mandero, hinted at how it interprets that language. So then the burden, as it were, shifts to the corporation to make it clear that the waiver is not as broad as we have suggested. And absent doing that, then this court is bound to apply this sort of does it impermissibly interfere with the core purposes of the corporation. In other words, all of the points that Judge Randolph was raising through his questions don't eliminate this court's obligation to stick with our interpretation of Article 6, or is it that we really have never addressed Article 6? Well, I understood the corporation in part to be arguing is, look, we have blanket immunity, and normally a waiver of immunity must be very explicit.
Well, that
and
is...
It's basically saying this court is mistaken in its interpretation of Article 6. But as you point out, it really hasn't indicated why on sort of this promissory estoppel claim it would necessarily interfere, and that the burden given our previous interpretation is on the corporation to indicate why this would necessarily interfere.
Well, it has that burden to overcome the apparent advantage that a waiver would grant them, and which I think is clearly present here. Then it has the burden to show that it would substantially hamper them, and that is one of my principal points, is that they haven't really attempted to address that burden. They just say, well, it would allow anyone negotiating with us to sue us. Well, so lots of major corporations around the world exists with the understanding that when they negotiate with people, those people may end up suing them if they commit a legal wrong. And I don't know that IFC has ever put forth any reason why it should be treated differently, why those rules shouldn't apply to it, why those rules would hamper IFC simply because it's an international organization. It engages in normal commercial transactions. That's its whole purpose.
If we agree with you, that is, if the district court's analysis was correct, do we have to address this choice of law question at all?
I see no reason. The district judge didn't have to. The district judge applied the rule of Mendaro. That, as we see it, is a federal rule. It doesn't matter what law applies to the merits of the claim in order to apply the Mendaro test. And in none of the cases that I've read involving either the foreign sovereigns or the international organizations has any court ever found it necessary to decide what law will apply to the merits of the underlying controversy. So I think that issue is really not present here. The IFC also presents as an issue whether the district judge correctly or incorrectly assumed the truth of the allegations of the complaint. It's true the district judge, in reciting all the general principles applicable to this kind of analysis, quoted a case to that effect, but it could not be clearer that the district judge, in applying the Mendaro test to this case, didn't assume the truth of any allegations.
I mean, even if he was wrong, it doesn't make
it difference. Makes no difference, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Unless the court has further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you.
Thank you.
About 2 minutes.
Thank you, I appreciate it. I think what Mr. Joseph said that I want to respond to is he compared IFC to just another a big corporation that operates in the world. But that's fundamentally what IFC is not. What IFC is a quasi-government organization. When it was formed, as all the World Bank entities, they were formed with the idea that they would be able to function in the international world without being burdened by these kinds of potential attacks on them. They were created as quasi-sovereign entities. And as quasi-sovereign entities, they have certain attributes and certain rights that ordinary commercial entities don't have, one being this form of immunity.
Well, that argument was made in Mendaro and rejected. the argument that there are many corporations around the world are subject to suits because of their employment practices and blah, blah.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to it directly. I think ultimately the test that a court should apply here is to look at what is the actual direct relationship between the potential plaintiff and the IFC. And we actually did address the issue of whether negotiations would whether that would hinder or help IFC's operations. This is discussed in the Van Bilsen Declaration that begins at A60 of the appendix.
Where is it discussed in your brief? Where in your brief do you take the sort of global approach that Judge Tatel was talking about and say, look, if you give this guy, if this guy can bring this suit, then in the future our negotiations with other individuals will have the following effects?
I don't think we really got to it in our brief simply because we were dealing with what the court did below, and the court below did not actually consider these issues. And part of our point is that they should have been considered, that the way IFC, in fact, does business is to be very careful and is very transparent with its counterparty that they're not going to have a deal until they're a deal. If you look on page 26 of our brief, though, as my colleague Mr. Panopoulos has just given me, there is some discussion of this in the context of the of what what benefit IFC would get or not get in terms of this particular claim, and what we're looking at and what we think we should.
This is under the section dealing with choice of law. Right.
Yeah, it's under, but we're discussing Atkinson here at the bottom of 26.
Okay.
And whether there would be a corresponding benefit given the relationship between the parties. I think the analysis should be what is the relationship between the parties, and given what the parties intended, what the parties were doing, is
that's assuming that the law of Guernsey applies, right?
Yeah, but I think that the analysis is the same idea that what a court should be looking at when they do this kind of analysis is to look at the relationship between the parties in whatever aspect it believes that is pertinent to the issue. I guess the other thing I wanted to point out.
Can I just ask you, when I looked at this affidavit that you just referenced, I thought that was going to the merits of whether there was a contract, not the point you're making as to whether allowing suit would interfere with a corporation's ability to.
Well, the original purpose of it was in response to a preliminary injunction motion.
No, but I'm just saying the text of it. Does it say anything there to support your point that allowing a suit just based on negotiations would interfere? I just didn't see it. I mean, I may have missed it. That's why I'm raising it. In other words, had the district court read this, and we assume he read it, what there would have obligated him to deal with this issue?
I think it's it comes from the argument. This just tells you, because we go back and forth saying, well, would just plain negotiations, would that further IFC's mission in life? And our answer to that is no, because in fact, during negotiations, IFC is very clear that it never intends to actually have a relationship or an agreement with somebody until they finally get to that point. And that is the way IFC does business, so that the way IFC does business is to cut these square corners.
Thank you. The case is submitted.
Thank you.